from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you, and by support from the Central Indiana Community Foundation, the Indiana Arts Commission, a state agency, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, a federal agency.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll chat with storyteller Susan Grizel.
I'll talk with Greg Lucas about the future of his art gallery.
And I'll find out about the Ryberg Reading Series at IUPUI. Plus, there's our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Healthcare has not always been fodder for talk about reform. In fact, there was a time in early Indiana history when medicine featured some pretty colorful remedies that had absolutely nothing to do with politics, as Sharon Gamble found out when she invited storyteller Susan Grizel into our studios to talk about her upcoming Storytelling Arts of Indiana event called Root Doctors, Midwives, and Fried Mice Pie.
I want to know how you got started in storytelling in the first place.
Well, my father says.
Uh-oh, it goes way back.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I used to give performances of dramatic performances for my toys and so on. Yes, and as I was an avid collector of certain comic books, I would give dramatic readings and things.
For
like
example?
That. Well, let's see. The Fantastic Four introductory edition was a rousing hit with Shirley Temple and assorted bears, and I had a dog named Bob Dylan too. Yes, he liked it too.
Oh my. I don't know whether to take that bait or not.
Well, don't. But no, and
do you
then
have siblings?
I have an older sister, and as you can well imagine, with family there's always storytelling, and I come from Appalachia. So, lots of storytelling. I grew up hearing older relatives, neighbors, on the porch on Sundays, always talking. I mean, that was just how information was passed on. And we do it even now, even today. We just don't realize and recognize it necessarily as formal storytelling.
Yeah, you touched on something I wondered, which is, did somebody have to give you the label for yourself of storyteller, or was this just in the air?
Well, in a way, yes. I mean, I was, as you can imagine, a child such as I might drift into theater. So so while I was working for Lexington Children's Theater, it's a professional children's theater in Lexington, Kentucky, mm-hmm. and they have a theater school. And I was asked to take the story class, the younger children. I had always taught older, generally high school age acting. And they asked me to take the younger children, and it was called a storytelling class or story theater class. Hmm. And a dramatic arts magazine, which was for teachers of theater, and I believe it was published out of Cincinnati, it had a feature story on the National Storytelling Festival in Jonesboro, Tennessee. I had never heard of it. I put myself in my little car and drove down there and met wonderful people and was astonished at the variety of art forms that fall under the heading storytelling. Some people do it with masks. Some people do it with puppets. Some people are very dramatic and include music. And a tiny elderly woman from Canada named Alice Kane got up, and I thought, oh, who's this tiny little white-haired lady? Mm-hmm. Seemed afraid of the microphone. She opened her mouth, and the world went away, and we were in ancient Ireland with Gobnu the Wondersmith and Finn McCool and all the heroes of ancient Irish lore, and I was hooked, just hooked.
How magical.
It was. It truly was. So
when you first realized, hey, I am a storyteller, I need to sort of refresh my thinking or change mm-hmm. my thinking about who I am, did the the formal structures that you saw these other tellers using get in your way at all, or did you just have to kind of figure out, well, this is my natural rhythm, this works for me?
There is a certain way. I think everyone has to, as they say, find their own voice, mm-hmm. just as anyone who writes finds their own voice. And yes, if you have formal training, it can get in your way. And I ran into some prejudice against me because I was coming from a theater background.
Really?
Yes. And I was running into people who had grown up in their family traditions, storytelling. And there's so many oral traditions in so many different cultures. And I can't say that there was a lot of hindrance, you know, and hesitation because I was coming from theater. But in those early days, and this I'm talking about the 70s, late 70s, early 80s, the storytelling movement on the national scene was small enough then, and it seemed to be a small core group that, you know, people were really feeling their way and not too sure about us highfalutin so-called theater people. When you look at what storytelling has become, tens of thousands of people come to this tiny town in Tennessee, you know, for a week every year to go to the storytelling festival, and that's not the only one. Now there are storytelling festivals, I think, in every state, and sometimes some states have multiple storytelling. Storytelling Arts Indiana came about because you had three young people here who were astonished by the art of storytelling when they heard stories.
Speaking of storytellers, the Indiana Indiana Historical Society and the Indiana History Center are our state's storyteller, and you've made use of some of their materials in
Absolutely.
Researching this new piece. I have to ask, don't give everything away, but I must ask about fried mice pie.
I had a feeling you were going to ask about that.
How could I not?
I actually have a recipe, but I'm not going to give it to you now. But but fried mouse pie or fried mice pie is actually been listed in numerous sources as a cure for bedwetting, among other things. But you don't always have to have it in a pie. I have a copy here of a page from some German immigrants that came to Indiana, both father and son, John and August Betts. For some reason, they shared the same diary. The father kept it for a number of years, and when he passed away, the son started in the same book.
They looked ahead. They knew you were going to get in the archives at some point.
And it was quite
appreciate that.
Yeah. And as a matter of fact, this diary, I found out that Norbert Krapf referred to it and used excerpts from it in one of his novels. Mm-hmm. And I'm afraid that title escapes me, but in the diary, there's an entry about if a person has problem with bedwetting, they should take a young blind mouse and burn it in the fire until it's crisp, and then you mash those crispy little mouse bits into a powder, and you eat it in something, and it will keep you from wetting the bed. Isn't that exciting? Don't you think that you would find that delicious on your toast one
morning? I think that the threat of that might cause a
child over your
to do something
meal.
Else.
Yes.
That's right.
Yes, but I have a recipe for fried mouse pie. You fry the mice before you bake them
Well, of course.
Pie. Yes,
sure.
Yes. But, you know, you take all the unpleasant bits outside, and then you end up with these probably incredibly tiny pieces of meat. But I've eaten groundhog and squirrels, so I don't know that.
It's not that far of a stretch. Yeah.
I told my daughter the recipe. She's 9, and she said, "Well, that doesn't actually sound that bad."
So, in your research, how far back did you go, and where do you draw the line? Because I think sometimes, as people living in the year 2010, we think modern medicine mm-hmm. just one day it was not here, and the next day it was here. But it feels to mm-hmm. me in reading as though there's a big old transitional period where there were folk remedies and some science, but there was one foot in each country still.
Well, in what we know of as modern medicine and medicine backed up by science mm-hmm. kind of really got a huge boost by the Civil War. And if you look over history, it generally seems that wars are a period of innovation in medicine, unfortunately. Mm. And so I pretty much stop my story stops right about when the Civil War, around 1860, is when I have kind of called a cutoff point. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to focus on the earlier years, which is quite a challenge because not a lot of people left really great records. Indiana was still much more of a pioneer state. I mean, we didn't become a state until 1816.
Mm-hmm.
So I have been looking at records from the 1700s up to 1860 and a little bit beyond to get an idea of how some theories that were already being considered or tried out might have developed. Because the 1800s, the 19th century, forceps came into general use in childbirth. Only physicians had it. People began to actually accept and believe germ theory, that there are microorganisms that can cause disease. And
wow.
And because everyone thought, well, you either get sick because you're a bad person, because you drink too much, you eat too much, you live in a dirty place, or you're in foul air.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was, people were, they just didn't want to understand because firmly held beliefs, it was difficult for them to accept things that European researchers and gradually American researchers were starting to develop.
And also, those are forces beyond your control.
Yes, they are.
Whereas you can control, maybe
yes.
I'll not have that glass of wine, or maybe I'll go to church more often.
That's
or
right.
Whatever it is.
Well, if you think you can cure your warts by squeezing all the blood out of a recently killed sheep's lung, once you bleed it and you squash it until whatever moisture is in there comes out, you keep that moisture and you rub it on your warts, and you can control that. Whereas
right.
knowing that there's a virus that would cause that wart, that can't happen. You know, if you feel like your brain, you're slow-witted or brain, there's actually, I have a recipe here that you take goat's milk and inhale it through your nose 3 or 4 times a day, and this says this will entirely remove from the brain all obstruction. It's
really?
Called How to Purge Your Brain.
What was the movie a few years ago, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind?
That's right. I never saw goat milk in that movie.
No.
But
no.
I'm sure if it had been suggested, Jim Carrey would have tried.
Okay, now I have to ask you, what's the grossest medical treatment or folk medic?
Well, now that would be a contest. Now here is one, if we have the time. This is a little long, but this is called for palsy, which basically would mean, you know, nervous shaking.
Mm-hmm.
You first let the patient thoroughly cleanse the blood, which basically means you purge your body. You mm-hmm. use laxatives, et cetera. And those were very popular, laxatives, things to make you vomit, and so on. So when you talk about gross, there were a lot of heinous things done. But after you cleanse your body out, you take some lady slipper, angle worms, basically fish, you know, mm-hmm. worms, turpentine, lobelia seed, or oil of oregano, oil of spruce, oil of cinnamon, 4 green frogs alive, and you put these all in a stone vessel, and then you shut it, and you put that under a heap of rotten manure, and you leave it stopped up under there for 10 days.
Ugh.
Then you take it out and strain it. Wouldn't that be fun? And you rub all the afflicted parts of your body with the solution that you get after you strain out those frogs and worms and other things, and you just wrap yourself up in flannel as warm as can be borne, and then you drink plenty of sage, pennyroyal, or horse mint tea while you've got frog and worm and other oils wrapped up in flannel on your body. And you should be cured. And it says, I warrant them a speedy cure. And there's another recipe where you put, half a dozen earthworms in a glass bottle, and you stopper it well with wax, and you leave it in the sun. for several days, and the resulting mass is used to cure, I believe, dry skin. So.
Sharon Gamble with storyteller Susan Grizel. You can hear her upcoming Storytelling Arts of Indiana event called Root Doctors, Midwives, and Fried Mice Pie on Sunday, January 24th from 4 to 6 p.m. at the Frank and Katrina Basile Theater inside the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana History Center. The event is a collaboration with the Indiana Historical Society, where Susan found materials to develop her story. You can buy tickets at the door, or you can get them at a discount in advance by calling 317-232-1882. Again, 232-1882.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. After a career in banking, Greg Lucas opened up his art gallery in the Meridian Kessler neighborhood in 1994. In 2007, he moved the G.C. Lucas Gallery to Mass Ave, and at the end of 2009, he closed the doors of the gallery. He will continue to represent many artists and sell work to collectors, but without a physical space. Travis DiNicola spoke with Greg about the gallery and about what happens now.
Greg, Happy New Year, and welcome to Art of the Matter.
Thanks, Travis. Happy New Year to you.
Thank you. This is going to be an interesting year for you, I'm guessing. I am a big fan of the work that you've done for the past 15 years through the G.C. Lucas Gallery, was up in Meridian Kessler, then down on Mass Avenue. But the physical gallery actually just closed. And so, as I said to you when I asked you to come on the show, my question is for you, what next? Because I know you have a lot of plans as far as things to do.
Right. We found that it was time to change the model of the way that we sell art. So we're approaching it with an online presence, a virtual gallery, if you will, more private showings, smaller showings in interesting venues, and hopefully then increasing the size of our audience with the internet, but continuing to serve our existing clients with these smaller shows and then their access to the website as well.
Is this a trend that you see happening with other galleries as well, and moving more to having a virtual space as opposed to a physical storefront presence?
I think it is definitely a trend, and I think it is necessary because particularly in a market the size of Indianapolis and you know, markets this size, it's very difficult to have the critical mass you need to first overcome the overhead and then to make a profit. So for art galleries that are interested in making a living for their owners, you have to have a way to reduce the overhead, and it makes sense this way. The overhead is much less, and the audience, or the potential audience, is much, much larger. So I think lots of people are doing it. I know many galleries that have considered doing it and are starting to do it, and then you couple it with, you know, some other ideas, and it may be a model that, you know, keeps us in business for a long time, hopefully.
Now, to be fair, I know that this probably wasn't your first choice, though, as far as how to go about things.
Right. I have to say that I'm probably one of the luckier people on the planet for the last 15 years to be able to have a gallery space, to enjoy what really, for galleries, becomes a community of artists and a community of patrons and a community of collectors and a community of new people to the art market that you get to educate, and that's a fantastic thing, and I truly enjoyed it, but I'm also a pragmatist, and you can only have a not-for-profit organization for so long if you're in a for-profit business.
Make it a profit, yeah.
If I'm trying to live, yes. So it just was not going to be possible with our current configuration to do that. And rather than giving up completely, I think it's much better to let's see if we can't do it a better way.
You know, one thing, Greg, that I am going to miss about your gallery, you mentioned, of course, the sense of community. I mean, it's always great coming in on a first Friday night and being able to, you know, meet an artist and chat with other people about work that you like. But just being able to, you know, walk into your space, and you carry many artists that are, you know, museum quality. And I want to talk a little bit about these artists in just a moment. But that was a pleasure too, to be able to, you know, see some of these pieces, whether it was like a William Forsythe or what have you, in person. Now getting those online, how are you then go about doing that? Or is it a matter of, you know, high resolution photographs or descriptions, or because I know you're really working through the process of creating this online gallery now.
Well, I think that first of all, you should know that you can't really do a high resolution photograph, or it becomes something printable, and you have, you know, all sorts of copyright issues. And so most websites that you'll see are, you know, fairly low resolution. If mm-hmm. they are high resolution, you have to have some way to keep them from being reproduced. So I think, you know, the image, the concern with an image is that I think that you can see color fairly well, although each monitor is different.
Sure.
So what I see when I put it online is different than what you might see when you see it online. The concern that I have is about the texture. You know, how do you see what the surface looks like
mm-hmm.
for a piece? Some artists are easy to photograph. Others are extremely difficult to get a decent image. So all of those things you have to play with. And I think what comes of it is that you learn to do the photography for an artist in an individual way. And that's nothing wrong with that. I mean,
mm-hmm.
that's the way art is. They're individual, so I should learn to be able to present them individually. Ultimately,
I mean, you did that, you know,
sure,
in creating a
absolutely.
Show at the gallery.
It's no different than putting the lighting on them
mm-hmm.
when I hang. Some shows you hang with very little lighting. Other shows you have to hang with a lot of lighting,
mm-hmm.
depending on how the piece was created and the angle of light that the artist painted in. All of those
sure.
things are factors. It's no different online. I think beyond that, I think we can do a lot in terms of description that I've been in the business long enough to know to sort of what the frequently asked questions are about each artist, and, you know, creating those stories and being able to convey them, I think, is an important thing. As I become more sophisticated, I'd almost like to do that in a video kind of format where they can see me talking about the artist or see the artist talking about the artist.
Sure.
But, you know, that's down the road. I have to, you know, take small steps and get the things online and do it more with written descriptions and things now. But ultimately, I think you can do a lot with explaining how that painting works and why it works, just like you would in a gallery environment. Again, though, you don't see the painting in the same way. And so one of the things that I can do for my existing clients is they can see that painting in
mm-hmm.
person. I can take it to them and show it to them in their home, or they can come and see it
right.
in a different venue.
And you'll still be doing that. You'll be.
And I still mm-hmm. will be doing that, certainly in the Indianapolis area.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the sort of what happens in the industry is if someone in Connecticut wants to see a painting by one of our artists, you send it out on approval. They actually see it in their home, and then, you know, if they don't like it, it comes back. But
and that's no different from how it would have been when you had the physical space.
It's exactly the, you know, what we've done for the last 15 years for people that are out of market that want to see something. So
I see this really interesting in terms of the evolution of the gallery and you know, actually my thesis for my master's work was in looking at how art museums
uh-huh.
could start using the internet, and this was back in the early 90s. And at that time, really, it's funny because what you're saying is in some ways no different from what was being discussed then, is that, you know, no matter what, you can't reproduce the work online. But what you can do is you can provide a lot of other information about it that maybe you couldn't in a gallery or museum space, and potentially you can actually reach more audiences than you ever could with the limitations of just a physical presence. Because
yeah.
In a sense, there's no geography for you anymore.
But in theory, there is no geography. That's correct. I think you spend a lot more time in this environment, sort of prepping things and getting things together, it's time consuming to make them look great on the internet.
Yeah.
You know, that takes a lot of time that you might have spent with a client. So, you know, learning to balance that is going to be something new for me. The potential for being overwhelmed by success frightens me a little bit. What if the bigger audience is suddenly crazed for paintings and I can't keep up? So I hope that's a problem that I get to contend with very soon.
Sure, why?
But it is possible that if we're wildly successful, then it will lower our level of customer service, which I think is one of the strengths that we've always had as a gallery, is caring about the client and making sure they get what they want and providing good service. So that does scare me a bit, but we'll face that hopefully when it comes.
Now, I know you've mentioned possibly organizing some shows, not, again, not having an ongoing gallery space, but having some shows at some point. Would those be public or by invite, or how would that work?
I think it could work either way. The next one that we're planning is a Valentine's Day kind of thing, and that would be by invitation. But I've had discussions with some other dealers who find themselves in the same position, that we may do a broader, more public presentation of art, with showing artists that a greater variety than I show myself, but then combining our customer lists and inviting a much broader audience and making it more of a public showing. So we've discussed some of those things as well. And then I have some other ideas of finding new audiences that I, you know, through the not-for-profit sector, and hopefully helping them in some fundraising. So that may be another approach that we would take, which would be a more public kind of setting.
Tell me a little bit about some of the artists that you represent. Many Hoosier artists, as well as contemporary artists working in landscapes and figurative work.
Our work is primarily traditional, although we've represented some artists that are more abstracted in the kinds of things they do, but they're all observational, is what I would call it. They actually looking at something when they produce it. We don't have anyone that's a conceptual artist or are completely abstracted from just what they're thinking. And we will continue to represent local artists like Karen Chevalier Smith and Lorraine Sack. We will continue to represent artists like Michael McEwen, who's been very popular landscape painter, Cindy Nixon, a painter from Cincinnati. Red Rojal will continue, sort of former Indiana person now in Arizona. Red Rojal will continue with us, and we've retained almost certainly the majority of the artists that we were showing in person, and then hopefully as time progresses, we may pick up some new artists that like what we're doing and want to join the gallery. So I think that collectors that know us will be very pleased to see many of their favorite artists are still there, just in a different format.
That's very important that the artists that you've been working with have also chosen to still continue to have you represent them, even though you won't be able to, you know, have that physical gallery space year-round. But
they're
but
very
still
excited about, you know, let's do something new.
Yeah.
The old model, if it's not working for me, it's not working for them either.
Sure.
They need sales, and they see this as an opportunity. And many of them have tried doing, you know, an online presence on their own. But the difference is that my job is selling paintings. Their job is making
them,
paintings.
Yeah.
And many of them have not found it to be very successful for them. So they're excited to see what I can do with it as a concept. And, you know, there will be times when they get to come to shows just like they used to and meet the clients and just as we used to do. Some of those things will still take place. So they're very excited about that opportunity as well.
I think something very important that you said was, you know, that the old model is not working. And as much as, you know, we may miss it, and I'm certainly going to miss having, you know, your gallery to just walk in and look and see what's, you know, there, and you know, and I miss, you know, having, you know, an abundance of art galleries. Also, Mark Rushman is another example of a gallery, very different type of work, but you know, that had been around in Indianapolis for a long time and closed over the summer. You know, but as you said, the old model's not exactly working anymore, and it does open up a lot of new potential that can be very positive. Though, again, you know, I know the transition's a little, it's going to be strange at times.
Well, it's certainly different to not have a physical place to go. And I hear that from my clients, you know, what are we going to do now that there's not this place to go? And I said, I'm still me, and, you know, I still have the same phone number that I've had for 15 years. If you need to see me, call that phone number, and you can see me. So, I mean, part of that is just putting to rest my fears and their fears that you know, that we'll never see each other again, that this community has ended. And it certainly hasn't done that. I mean, I'm in contact with artists today, multiple artists, just today about what's coming up in February. You know, where do we go from here? Let's talk about the kind of work you're doing. So I think it's very possible to continue a gallery in a different mode and to try to make it successful for everyone. Mm-hmm. And I'm optimistic that we'll make that happen.
Travis DiNicola with Greg Lucas. The new website for Greg Lucas's gallery, gclucasgallery.com, will be launched this week. And that website again, gclucasgallery.com. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon?
Do you hear that sound?
What is that sound?
It's the sound of dry needles dropping off evergreen trees across our fair city.
Followed by the sound of your vacuum cleaner getting
getting clogged up with them. Yes.
You, there's nothing worse than needles and cat hair to clog up a vacuum cleaner.
And the best is when you're still finding pine needles whatever your tree is, needles, you know, 6 months later that we're hiding somewhere. Why am I mentioning this?
Why are you mentioning that?
Well, I'll tell you, because, yes, it's a hint for something that's going on our calendar that we call,
What do we do
with our Christmas trees?
Yes, it's time to take them down.
It's time to take them down.
I'm convinced, pine needles and cat hair is, I think, stronger than concrete.
Oh, my gosh, a new building material.
There you go.
I love it. I bring it up because the Indy Parks are still accepting trees at several locations, and they will be recycled and made into mulch.
Right.
And it's a good thing. You, of course, need to take the ornaments off of them and take tinsel and
you know, all your lights and stuff.
Yeah, all that kind of stuff.
Throw it in the car and take it out. It's like Ellenberger Park.
Broad Ripple Park.
Yeah.
Excellent idea.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent
Very good.
Idea.
And then go out and see some art.
That's right. Reward yourself for your clean living room.
Yeah. opening this weekend, The Housewives of Mannheim at the Phoenix Theater by Alan Brody. And this is a real interesting play. A group of housewives getting together in 1944, sort of sitting around the table talking about their lives in Brooklyn. And very, very sharp, witty dialogue. Should be a lot of fun. Again, Housewives of Mannheim at the Phoenix through February 6th.
And here's something coming up in a week or a little over a week. You've got about a week and a half on this one. It's called Molto Piano, which is both a term expressing a dynamic in music, but also a descriptive term because you're going to hear not one, not two, but three pianists. University of Indianapolis's resident faculty ensemble Molto Piano presents works for piano duet, duo, and trio. Now, that's something you don't hear every day, including music by Schubert and Arensky and William Bolcom, and, as they say, much, much more. That's coming up on Monday, January 25th at 7:30. Jacqueline Chan, Sharon Parr, and Rebecca Sorley are Molto Piano at the DeHaan Fine Arts Center, 7:30, Monday, January 25th. Absolutely free. How could you resist?
Free is good.
Free is good.
Hey, for Saturday night, if you're looking for a fun sport event and sporting event.
Oh, I know what this is.
Well, and you know, perhaps you don't have tickets for that football playoff game, or you just want to see some people play who play all innings and bouts and whatever as it may be. Well, the Naptown Roller Girls are going to be competing on Saturday night, the 16th, against Louisville's Derby City Roller Girls. The bout takes place at 7:30 up at the State Fairgrounds, Pepsi Coliseum, and whether these girls are hurt or not, they will bout for all four quarters.
Okay. You know all that terminology. I'm so proud of you. What's your favorite Naptown Roller Girl? What are they called? Is it an alias?
Oh, yeah, they have their
names. Is that what you call
names.
It, an alias?
Toretta Lynn I always thought was great. Snacky Onassis, though, I think is perhaps one of the most fantastic names.
Okay. Only in America. Although, I suppose it's spread elsewhere in the world. Well, anyway, Bus Stop is coming up at Indianapolis Civic Theater. It's what happens in a single night when a group of strangers gets stranded at a bus stop, and unexpected things happen. There's some humor, but there's a lot of combustible material in Bus Stop, and it's endlessly fascinating. It opens on stage at Civic Theater on January 22nd, coming up shortly, and runs through February 7th. So check out Bus Stop at Indianapolis Civic Theater.
Great script, great play. Yeah, looking forward to seeing that. Another pretty good script is Romeo and Juliet, and that opens at the IRT on January 19th.
Did you just say that?
Yeah.
It's a pretty good
it's
script.
Pretty good. It's, yeah. Sorry. So, you know,
you caught me off guard.
Yeah. So the IRT is producing that, and they're doing a little bit different. Actually, it should be really interesting what they're doing, because they're using race as the divisive issue between the Capulet family, which is African American, and the Montague family, which is Caucasian, in this production of the IRT, runs through February 27th. Yeah, pretty good script.
I don't know how to go from Shakespeare in a pretty good play, Romeo and Juliet, to The Egg and I, featuring Marjorie Main as Ma Kettle. I'm just going to leap. this is a showing at Central Library's Clues Auditorium, which you ought to go in if you haven't been in there yet, at 2 o'clock on this Sunday, January 10th. The Egg and I will be screened, and you can hear a pre-screening discussion by Indiana Historical Society author David Smith. This is part of the Hoosiers Film Series. Hoosiers Film Series, The Egg and I, this coming Sunday, January 10th, 2 o'clock, Central Library, Clues Auditorium, free, open to the public, and you get to hear David Smith, who is a very smart guy and knows everything there is to know about the movies.
Very, very cool.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Sharon, time to take out that Christmas tree if you've not already. And we will be back next week with more great arts events on this calendar we call
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
In 1997, the Rufus and Louise Ryberg Reading Series at IUPUI brings national and regional writers of note to its urban campus for the enrichment of students, faculty, staff, and also the general public. Sharon Gamble invited IUPUI's Karen Kovacic and Terry Kurtz into our studios to learn more about the series' genesis, its history, and its all-star Poet Spring.
Let's talk about the Rufus and Louise Ryberg Reading Series. We should establish for people who maybe haven't lived here a long time or don't know who the Rybergs are. What's the connection?
Well, Rufus Ryberg was the chair of the English department at IUPUI for a number of years, and he originally endowed the series, or his family did, around the time of his death. And then his widow, Louise Ryberg, was an ardent supporter of our series for many years. She passed away in 2006, and her family continues the legacy by supporting our series. They come to just about all of our events. But both were really zealous patrons of the arts in general and our series in particular.
Yes, it was wonderful to see Louise up until the end coming as long as her health held out. She, no matter who was on stage or what words came out of the mouth of the reader, she was supportive of it and was just extremely gracious with the readers we brought in.
She had a beautiful halo of silver hair, and she always had very colorful silk scarves and, you know, cut quite a figure.
And somewhat of a writer herself, too. Wrote some poetry as well. So,
yeah, and I should mention, as we're having this conversation, we're everybody who cared about writing and especially about poetry is still trying to wrap his or her mind around the passing of Ruth Lilly.
Well, that's right.
Great supporter, patron of the arts, and particularly of poetry.
Indeed, I actually did my graduate work on a fellowship that Ruth Lilly endowed at Indiana University, and I am grateful for that opportunity. The auditorium we have our readings in is the Lilly Auditorium at the IUPUI University Library. So her spirit is with us as well.
That's a good thing. Good energy. This series is. Oh, not quite 15 years old. Started in 97, 98 year. And it strikes me that at some point somebody said, well, gosh, it would be great to bring in contemporary writers. But it's almost an embarrassment of riches. How do you decide who to bring in and how do you make that decision annually? And is there, do you try to sync up course content with the writers who are coming in, or vice versa?
Yeah, we do. And we're like every reading series, we're a bit limited by budget.
Sure.
So we typically bring in about 7 writers a year, and try to link the curriculum and our courses to their work. We try for a balance of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry, though this year we're very poet rich.
I did notice that. Not that that's a bad thing.
That's okay,
I just thought that's so cool.
So, and we aim for diversity of many sorts, racial, ethnic,
age.
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm.
This year we've been very fortunate. We were able to get some funds because IUPUI celebrated its 40th anniversary in 2009, and so we were able to bring in MacArthur Fellow and memoirist Patricia Hample in the fall. And while she is still somewhat in the Midwest up in University of Minnesota, she's someone we may not have brought from that distance in the past. Often we will bring in writers who have a new book, a recent award of some sort, or who are on a tour trying to read from their book and promote that book. And
that helps your budget, too, if you can piggyback
a little bit,
on what they're doing already.
Yes,
yeah.
Especially, and sometimes we will share with other universities. In the fall, we had a reading by poet Khaled Matawa, who had already given a reading at DePauw University. So,
What is your mission for this series? What do you ultimately want to do?
Well, for our students, we want to bring a wider literary world to Indianapolis. And for the community?
I'd say for the community, we want to show Indianapolis that IUPUI has a vibrant writing program, that we value the writing of authors from Indiana and around the Midwest and the country, and that we truly value the performance of poetry, fiction, nonfiction, beyond just what one would read in a book or find at the library or study in a class.
Because literature should be for the stage as well as the page.
Have you found that sometimes writers that you bring in surprise you with what they do in reading out loud? Like maybe you had one voice in your head just reading it on the page, and then you think, I had no idea she would be so dynamic, or wow, he's shy. Who knew?
Definitely, we've had some interesting experiences with meeting the readers. As often, a poet whose work is very, very formal and tightly woven on the page may be quite a boisterous person in real life, and vice versa. And that's been one of the joys of being a part of this series since its beginning, is to meet the writers. I think one of the great experiences is to hear from the students, and many of them will write a report for a class they've attended the reading for, and they will say, wow, I never expected this writer to be just an average, you know, a person who wakes up in the morning and
puts his pants on one leg at a time.
Her pants, yes. And that's been really, I think, the most valuable part of it for me, to see students who say, hey, that woman up there who is a writer is not that different from myself or my mother or my aunt, and I think I could do that. And it really inspires them to want to write and to achieve more with their writing.
That's right. Or, you know, we routinely assign our students to attend one reading, you know, a semester.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes they dread going initially.
Hmm.
And they're afraid they're going
to
be absolutely
bored. I have
to
go hear this poet tonight.
But then they're so pleasantly surprised, you know, and then they want to go again. So I think we've converted many people.
It seems like in a day and age where everything is instantly available electronically over your computer or your phone, that it's even more important to have these three-dimensional encounters.
Oh, yeah.
I think that students have fewer formal kinds of experiences such as this, where they go to hear a writer and scholar in an auditorium like this, and many will report in those reports or to us anecdotally that this is the first time they've done anything like this, and it's really transformative, because I think that in the larger world we've lost that kind of ritual of going to events such as this. But ours are quite casual most of the time, and they're surprised that it could be enjoyable and that it isn't like a lecture in a classroom. So I think that that's great to expose young writers to that experience.
What's the, and I'm sure this is different depending on which writer/reader we're talking about, but what's the typical breakdown in the audience of students, faculty, other staff, general public? Do you have a sense?
Well, for a number of years, we would have our readings in the late afternoon, and so we mostly attracted a campus crowd. But for the last probably 6 years, we've been holding our readings at 7:30 p.m., and so we've attracted more people from the community. What would you say the breakdown is, Terry?
I think we're still more students from our courses at IUPUI, but and it depends, of course, on the reader and the appeal. But for the reading by Patricia Hample in the fall, we had a number of attendees who came from out of the city, some from Bloomington, some who had known Hample, and she's someone who has had a couple of best-selling memoirs, and so her appeal was wider than just our student body. And I think that that's also very valuable for students to see people who later in life are coming back to these readings and aren't just doing it because of...
They have to.
Yeah.
They get a demerit on there. They don't have to write a paper on it.
And something that also depends upon, we partner every spring with the Etheridge Knight Festival of the Arts, and that brings in a different population for our readings. And in the past, we've partnered with Spirit in Place as well as the Writer Center, and we've had some of their members come as well.
In addition to the public event, are you able to schedule with most of these folks some time to meet with students, with faculty?
We often do. Nin Andrews, one of the poets who will be reading on our campus this next semester, is coming to my intermediate poetry writing class, for example. And
she will also direct our Bonderman workshop, which is an opportunity for accomplished students who have won some of our awards in the spring to meet with a writer. And that's something that we do every spring. Patricia Hample gave a Q&A at our campus center, which attracted people from the community as well to talk about the art of memoir and issues of writing for her. So generally we have been able to get people to interact with the writer in a couple of contexts.
Sometimes the visiting writers on our campus have also given community workshops at the Writer Center.
That's cool. Share the wealth.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So we have a poetry-rich spring coming up. Let's talk about that.
Well, first in our lineup is four-time National Poetry Slam champion Patricia Smith, who will be the keynote speaker at the Joseph Taylor Symposium. The theme for that symposium is Voices in the City. And she'll be giving a reading open to the community, as all of our events are, at 7:30 p.m. Again, that's Thursday, February 25th.
And then we have a couple of three poets actually coming up in April, National Poetry Month. And to kick it off on the very first day of April is poet Nin Andrews, who's a two-time Ohio Arts Council grant winner and has several recent collections of quite ambitious and witty poetry. She has a book that's entitled Midlife Crisis with Dick and Jane, and then her new book that's coming out is entitled Southern Comfort.
But she's also the author of The Book of Orgasms.
And Spontaneous Breath.
Which, right.
Right.
How could you, even if you weren't interested in writing, I'm sure people's ears are perking up there.
And then
Jessica Kerr Moore, who is a deaf poetry alumna and has appeared on Slam Nation, will be performing her work Thursday, April 15th, 7:30 p.m. at the Indiana History Center, which is 450 West Ohio Street. That, again, is part of the Etheridge Night Festival for the Arts and promises to be a really dynamic event.
And if that's not enough, Edward Hirsch is coming on Wednesday, April 21st, also at 7:30 in the University Library Lilly Auditorium. And as Karen mentioned, he's an accomplished poet, winner of a National Books Critics Circle Award, MacArthur and Guggenheim Fellow holder, who has a new and selected poems coming out in 2010.
The Living Fire.
You may know him from the book How to Read a Poem and Fall in Love with Poetry, a national bestseller about the reading of poetry.
Sharon Gamble with IUPUI's Karen Kovacic and Terry Kurtz from IUPUI's Rufus and Louise Ryberg Reading Series. For dates of upcoming events, visit events.iupui.edu/calendar. Again, go to events.iupui.edu and calendar.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 4. I'll learn about the Heron School of Art's Basile Center for Art, Design, and Public Life.
Woo!
From Kathy Patalik.
Does that all fit on a business card?
A big card.
And, of course, we'll have our arts calendar we call
What Do We Do?
So please listen next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 to The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter is made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and by grants from the Arts Council of Indianapolis and from the City of Indianapolis and by support from the Central Indiana Community Foundation, the Indiana Arts Commission, a state agency, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, a federal agency. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.